The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Andy Duckworth. On this week's podcast,
from 40 to 65, we are at the top of our game.
When are our brains at their smartest?
The connections in our brains at middle age are faster, sharper than ever.
The New York Times science editor also reveals some handy tips and tricks for keeping your brain fit and healthy.
We can lose some brain branches, we can lose some neurotransmitters, can diminish a bit, but in general, if we're healthy, our brains can stay with us, active and sharp, you know, as long as we're around.
Plus, another of our unanswerable questions. This week, it gets a little cryptic.
Why are we so driven to convert one to the other?
And we head to the Royal Society in London.
It's very quiet at the moment because I'm quite early. But there's people arriving already, taxis pulling up.
And that's where we get overloaded with information.
Nobody can possibly keep track of everything. It becomes impossible to find the information you need.
Apparently, it's the modern era's defining quality.
It almost goes without saying that 140 characters doesn't let you express a thought of great profundity that's likely to be a contribution to knowledge.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back. Well, the science team has abandoned the building, leaving little old me, their producer, in charge of the podcast this week. Can you believe it? So, apologies in advance, but I'll do my best.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
I did manage, though, to line up a pretty good guest.
Okay. Do you want me to have the headphones on as well?
Unless you want to.
No, I don't care.
It's Barbara Strong.
I'm Barbara Strauch.
Oh, okay.
Happy to be here. Hello.
Thanks.
Fine.
Barbara's the science editor at that little-known paper, the New York Times.
I'm the science editor of the New York Times.
There's almost no point me being here.
And I've written a book called The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain.
Anyway, she's just written a book, continuing what appears to be a recent theme on our podcast, on what's going on inside our heads. The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain.
Which has a rather encouraging subtitle, which is The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. And that's what they are, kind of surprising talents.
I'll just check that I sound okay.
A quick disclaimer, Barbara confirmed I do not qualify as middle-aged yet.
You okay to go?
Okay to go.
First of all, just to start us off, what are the surprising things that a middle-aged mind can do?
For starters, we're smarter than we were when we were in our 20s. I think this is one of the big surprises. I myself thought that perhaps in college or graduate school that that was the peak of mental performance. And I think most of us think that, that it's kind of downhill from our 20s on. And for a long time, science thought that as well. They thought we lost 30% of our brain cells as we aged. Now they've got new tools. They look inside our brains and they find that's not true. And they have a lot of long-term studies now where they study, these are longitudinal studies where they study the same people every 7 years or so. These are thousands of people in very rigorous studies. And there's a bunch of very smart scientists who decided in the 1950s that this middle age we were having as humans was a new thing, and they should maybe look into what was happening. So we now have, from those very smart scientists, 40 years of very solid data about what actually happens as we traverse this modern middle age, which is really now with lifespan stretched out. You know, 1900, we lived on average 49 years. We now live on average 78. So we have this long time in the middle, a kind of plateau when we're healthy. Childhood vaccines and lack of childhood diseases mean that we're entering this long period much healthier on average than we ever did before. So we are, when they give the cognitive tests, for instance, they find that the brain continues to develop. We lose processing speed, sadly. There's no question about that. Might make it take us a little bit longer to learn that new computer system at work or whatever. But on the larger, more important cognitive functions, including things like logical reasoning, we peak in our early 60s. And from 40 to 65, we are at the top of our game. And I think that is unappreciated and really surprising, and was quite surprising to me. And when I was doing the research, I would then go out with friends, you know, for dinner afterwards, and I'd tell them this, and they'd say, you're crazy. You know, if I tried to go back to graduate school now in engineering or whatever, I would be toast. And I think that's because we focus on, you know, we kind of freak out about these little moments when we can't remember what we had for breakfast or the movie we saw or the name of that guy sitting across the table from us. So we worry. And that kind of masks, I think, what the abilities really are in this brain we have, which can really navigate our world very, very well.
Just run us through kind of the arc from birth to death of how the brain develops and what it's able to do, and where are the peaks, where are the troughs? What's going on there?
Well, that's a tall order, but let me take a crack at it. The baby brain is actually quite interesting, and we're born actually with more brain branches than we will need, and we kind of start getting rid of them along the way, depending on. And it makes sense when you think about a brain sort of being. You know, if you think of nature and a tree, really, it produces much more than it needs in terms of reproduction. You know, the buds on a tree, the flowers and the seeds and things are much more than would be necessary. And our brains are sort of set up that way, too. We get a bunch of brain branches that grow early on, and then they start waning a little bit, depending on what kind of environment we're in. It's set up to be adaptable. Neuroplasticity is the scientific term for it, and we see it from the get-go. It means that, of course, as a baby is developing in the womb even, it's very vulnerable, particularly its brain, to a lot of toxins. And as it comes out into its environment as well, a human brain is constantly trying to shift. Where am I? What do I need to do? You know, what do I need to learn? Where am I? You know, if a baby is born in a jungle, if a baby is born, you know, in a high rise, that baby needs to figure out what it needs to figure out. So the brain branches will grow and shape themselves along those lines. That kind of settles down. We have, in early childhood, we have a lot of the motor parts of the brain start to solidify. There's a coating on the brain cells called myelin. It's a fatty coating, and it makes the brain cells move much faster, the signals down them. And we have in the motor area around 8 or 9 kind of the end of myelination. So what that does is makes the signals move faster, but it also means there you kind of solidify your skills. So that's why it's important to teach young children a lot of the physical skills they'll need. And I think we all know that if you learn to play soccer when you're 7 years old, you're going to be pretty good at it and learn it faster than if you try when you're 40, for instance. The same thing with accents for foreign languages. Those areas start myelinating and develop quite young. So, you know, people who move around and learn a different language, they can learn it later on, but they may have, as Henry Kissinger did when he came to the United States, a heavy accent. He's a very smart man. He could never get rid of his accent. He came too late. So some parts of our brain solidify. And again, this myelination process is what makes them actually come alive, but more solid, really. And so then what we have in adolescence is a growth, really, of the part of the brain that makes us most human. And this is the part right behind our forehead, prefrontal cortex, which is huge in humans compared to our other relatives on the evolutionary tree, chimpanzees, and it's the part that helps us focus, see consequences of our behavior, solve problems, think abstractly. This is the part that's developing adolescence. It is not solidified. It is not myelinated. It is not set in stone. So we have another exuberance and a growth of brain branches around adolescence, and then a complete remodeling, a pruning back of perhaps 100% in some cases of those brain branches that you don't need. Again, a giant renovation, a giant adaptation of the brain. And so they thought, again, at 25, that's done, and maybe that's it. So what we've now found, and what they look at middle-aged brains, is that, whoops, that's not true. That certainly areas of the brain are solidified, but other parts of our brain continue to develop and grow. And they find this process, myelination in particular, continues and peaks in middle age. And this means that the connections in our brains at middle age are faster, sharper, than ever. And they think, some people think this is middle-aged wisdom altogether, this physical change in the brain. It only comes from myelination, some people think. And again, they thought it ended very early. They find with the new tools that no, it continues up into our 60s, sometimes a little bit later. So it means that our brains are still adapting, still growing, and still developing. And in fact, in many areas, and in fact, these areas of problem solving, getting the gist of an argument, connecting the dots, sizing up situations, that's what a well-connected brain can do, and that's what we have in middle age.
That's a pretty good stab at the whole arc there.
Didn't do death. It all ends.
Badly.
Badly. Right.
Something I found interesting in the book is the concepts of a cognitive reserve. What do you mean by that?
Cognitive reserve is a weird thing, and it means that, quite controversial, really, and quite new, and it means that if your brain's in good shape, you may be, through genetics or use or probably both, that you will be able to withstand the assault of disease or aging better. We have a lot of examples. There's one in the literature, the chess player from London is very, very famous. And he was a guy who could very smart move, think seven moves ahead, actually, in his chess playing. And one day he was in his 70s and he could only think four moves ahead. And he thought, something's wrong with me. Nobody else thought so. He was still a wonder guy. But he went to the neurologist, could find nothing. And he went back to his life and did the finances and computers and things, and eventually he died and found out that his brain was riddled with Alzheimer's, an advanced case. And so what he and another group of people, very famous, the Nuns study, these are people who are very active brains and they live a long time, and they find too that some of them have their brains riddled with Alzheimer's. So who are these escapees and how do they get around this? And some people are beginning to think this, they have what's called cognitive reserve, which is, which means that just like a soccer field is worn down in one part, you can go to another part if that other part is healthy and alive. So it means that if their brains are in good shape, one part can be damaged, but they can move, the brain will adapt and use a different part that's in still pretty good shape, and they can pretty much fake it longer. They see it in stroke, they see it in head injury, that people who have good brains, healthy brains, can, you know, adapt better. They actually get better faster. Stroke of the same severity, head injury the same severity. And even with normal aging, they think that if you have more working parts of your brain, it makes sense. You know, you just move over to the part that works.
Now, there's lots of fascinating work going on at the moment. Where do you see some of the major advances coming from, and where's this all going in the next 5, 10, 50 years?
Well, what they're really trying to do is figure out what it is that makes a brain stay good and put it in a pill. You know, this we're talking about, we've all heard about resveratrol, which is the ingredient in red wine that supposedly leads to longevity, and also that includes longevity for our brain cells. And they believe me, there's a lot of money working behind these people to try to put that in a pill and get those 15,000 glasses of wine a day into a little pill that's, you know, would leave us less drunk. So, and also with, you know, the antioxidants, the blueberries, with the omega-3s, the fish oils and things, they want to, the quantities that they think we need to really make an impact in our Western diet, which are pretty good, means they're going to have to figure out what's best and concentrate it. And there's a lot of very good science going on with chimpanzees, actually, feeding them a variety of things. And also throwing in exercise, which is clearly, in the studies of humans, the superstar for brain aging. And it increases brain volume, it increases cognitive skills, it increases the ability to make new baby brain cells. So no question that aerobic exercise in particular, walking around the canal three times or whatever, what you need to do is get your brain oxygen and blood. And so what they're trying to do is figure out what's best, and let us all know. They're also studying, now we have a lot of examples of people who are in their 90s or 100s and are intact cognitively. And we want to, it's not just a few people, you know, off somewhere on a mountain that actually are in this good shape. There's lots of people now. And so they're studying them to try to figure out, is it genetics? What role does lifestyle play? What can they do? What can we learn from them in terms of how we can all maintain our mental acuity late into our lives.
And just finally, your book contains a kind of a how-to section. Just for anyone listening, how can they improve their gray matter?
Well, my favorite one, aside from exercise, which is sadly the best, and those piles of blueberries, you might as well eat them because in the end, why not? You know, you want to not get strokes, not get hit on the head, and not get diabetes. Those are all bad for the brain. Obesity is bad for the brain, so avoid the bad things. But the one thing that uncomfortable thing that you might not want to avoid is they say that the brain at middle age is very good at recognizing patterns, which is true. We can size up situations, but that means we can also be in a bit of a rut. So to shake up that brain, you really need to, one of the best things I heard along the way was you talk to people who disagree with you, you know, get in a good argument, really. It doesn't mean that you have to change your mind, but it means you need to sort of challenge the presumptions of your own very good middle-aged brain, and then you'll get, in the end, a little more nuanced point of view, perhaps, and I think that's, to me, the most interesting part of all of this, that we need to appreciate the fact that our brains in middle age are set up for and very good at understanding nuance, subtlety, and the gray areas of life, and I think we've known that through the years with judges and presidents and things. We look to them to understand that kind of thing, but we didn't realize that the rest of us are pretty good at it too. And I think that's where society has to catch up a little bit and find out that and realize that a teacher or whatever is not past their prime. In fact, may very well be in their prime in middle age.
Barbara Strauch and her new book, which is called The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain. Make sure you're following us on Twitter at Science Weekly, and we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow at Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
So, time for this week's Hannaford question. You may or may not remember, this was the question sent in by one of our listeners. Someone's at the door. I reckon this is the podcast team, actually. They've come to surprise me. You see, it's my last program before I disappear to go travelling for a while. Okay, let's see who it is. Come in!
Hi, are you Andy?
Yeah.
I've been told to come up and see you.
All right, okay. Grab a seat, sit down. Pull up a chair. Get nice and close. Stick those on, your headphones. Who are you and what do you want?
I'm Becky Hill and I'm an intern here. I've got some audio you might be interested in.
Some audio, you say? Okay, that's quite useful actually, because I'll be honest with you, I didn't really have enough for this week's programme. What is it?
So I'm just walking down to the Royal Society now, and it's a very grand building on Carlton Terrace in London. I'm here for a talk by James Gleick called The...
Actually, it's pronounced James Glick. I found that out later on.
As I head over to the building, and hopefully we'll find out whether or not there's an information overload in the country.
The Royal Society, which one's that? I always get confused between the Royal Society and the Royal Institution.
Well, the Royal Society is the one that's above the Mall, which is the long road up to Buckingham Palace.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the big grand building, and it's got a great balcony. You'll get a fantastic view of the royal wedding
okay.
if you went there on the day.
I don't think I've had my invite yet. Okay. All right, well, let's have a listen.
It's very quiet at the moment because I'm quite early. But there's people arriving already. Taxi's pulling up. And hopefully we're in for a very enjoyable evening.
So a night out at the Royal Society sounds wonderful. What's it actually like kind of inside? It sounds very grand.
Well, this might help.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's very busy and you walk inside and there's big staircase. It's very grand and they've got lots of little artefacts and books that the Royal Society's picked up over the years. And there's one really nice bit of attention to detail that I really like because I'm a bit geeky. And in each of the door handles, there's a DNA double helix etched inside.
Wow, that is geeky.
On this connectedness, ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to present to you James Gleick. James.
See, even he got his name wrong.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Professor Hopper.
Oh, James Glick. Glick, yeah?
Glick, yeah.
Glick, okay. It looks like Glick. I remember now because his book's been on my desk for a couple of weeks, actually. What's it called? The Information.
Yeah, A History, A Theory, A Flood. And he'd been invited to the Royal Society to give a talk as one of their free public events.
You could say that 1948 marks the beginning of what people like to call the Information Age. Or, to put it another way, it's the moment when people began to realize that all human history was the Information Age.
This book has taken him 7 years to write. You may have seen some of his previous books, Chaos and Genius.
Sensations. Truth seems hard to find amid a multitude of plausible fictions.
He says he's come up with the modern era's defining quality, information.
All these. And the irony in all these cases is the same. Once a piece of paper is filed, it is statistically unlikely ever to be seen again.
He even says that we are information.
When information is cheap, attention becomes expensive.
And that it's changing the very nature of human consciousness.
We have met the devil of information overload and his impish underlings, the computer virus, the busy signal, the dead link, the PowerPoint presentation.
Signs and signals, news and images, blogs and tweets.
Many national libraries are actively preserving web pages, and the U.S. Library of Congress is even archiving the world's tweets. What takes effort is forgetting. To forget used to be a failing. Now it becomes a skill.
But bizarrely, he doesn't sound so keen on Twitter.
We have Yahoo and Google and Wikipedia and the rest of their oddly named species, and we generate unintended irony. We write astounding numbers of new books each year about information glut. Amazon transmits messages like, start reading Data Smog on your Kindle in under a minute. And surprise me, see a random page in this book.
I managed to grab a bit of one-on-one time with him, and I began by asking whether this deluge of information is anything new. Whether it's been a problem in the past.
Music, TV, poetry, books.
Everybody sort of feels as though something absolutely unique and unprecedented is happening now. People say there's so much information now that you can see just giving up. Nobody can possibly keep track of everything. It becomes impossible to find the information you need. The signal gets lost in the noise, and it's never been this bad. And a reassuring thing is that those complaints have been heard all through recorded history. Every new technology of information has brought complaints like that. The printing press, when Europe was suddenly flooded with books, brought the same sorts of complaints. And people said, this is a real turning point. It can never again be this bad, because for the first time in history, no one human can keep track of everything that's written. There are just too many books. Maybe 10,000 books existed in the world. On the other hand, this might be too many hands for this metaphor, but it's true. Things are worse today. We don't just have books, we have Twitter. Twitter didn't even exist when I started working on the information. And next year there will be something new. There are a lot of new channels. Cyberspace in itself, apart from any of the particular enterprises like Twitter, is something truly different. The ability of people to communicate all across the globe instantaneously, not just one-to-one, but one to a million or a million to one, is really new and changes the way we operate as a species.
Do you think that that's actually a problem? Do you think that we're trying too hard to understand the information, interpret the information and use it? Or do you think the problem might be more in how we use it, how we filter it and search through the information?
Well, I do think it's a problem. I think it's a challenge. It's not that we're trying too hard. It's that we need to find new ways of trying. And you just said filtering and searching are really the two essential strategies. And they always have been, but now more than ever.
Do you think we need to change the way we filter things? Do you think that's going to be the next step forward in using the information that we have?
Well, all of the new enterprises of the internet are about these two things, searching and filtering. You know, the funny name enterprises like Google and Yahoo and Wikipedia. Now, it's not obvious that they're about those two things, but they are, all of them. Searching in the sense of reaching out and finding information from, you know, finding the needles in a haystack, and filtering in the sense of blocking out all the stuff that you don't want, the rest of the haystack.
I've read that you say that science, there's a lot of information within science, and particularly within humans ourselves. I wonder whether or not you'd be able to say something about the way that you interpret information as being part of our bodies, our DNA.
My story begins in the middle with the invention of what engineers and mathematicians call information theory. And very soon after that, all sorts of disciplines found themselves fascinated by the language of information. And one of them, as we all know, is molecular biology, where genetics is all about information. We talk about the genetic code without thinking for a second about whether that's just a metaphor or something, and it's not a metaphor. Literally, DNA is a code. It's an alphabet of four letters, and those are information words too, alphabet and letters. So my view is that it's impossible to understand virtually any science today without thinking in terms of information.
Great, thank you very much.
So that was Becky Hill speaking to James Glick, and there's a link pointing you to more Royal Society events on our Facebook group. Just go and search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. Well, anyway, before I was rudely interrupted, it was time for another unanswerable brain teaser in the Hannaford question. Yes, listener Rob Hannaford suggested we ask every guest the same thing. If you had one question in the world that you could have answered, what would it be? So we did. So who's going to mess with our minds this week?
My name is David Eagleman. I'm a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine. And the question I would like answered is, neurobiologically speaking, what is a question? What is an answer? And why are we so driven to convert one to the other?
If you know the answer, stick it on our blog, guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Please show your working. Answers are at the back of your books. Okay, that's it for this podcast. Thanks to Barbara Strauch and James Glick, and a nod to David Eagleman too for his little mind bender. Thanks too to Becky Hill for interrupting me. Next week, well, your wonderful new producer, producer Jason, is keeping it, well, a secret from me. It's at this point that I'm actually expecting everyone, you know, Alok, Ian, Nell, maybe even Robin to burst through the studio door there. Surprise, they'll say. You didn't think we'd leave you on your own for your last pod before you go away? Oh, how we'd laugh. Ian and Alok would then present me with signed copies of their books. They're not here yet, though, but not that I was expecting them to play out any clips from 3.5 years of working on the podcast or anything. It'd be really embarrassing, actually, if that happened. So they'll be here any minute now. We're probably just waiting for me to finish this script, so I'll just get on with it. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced and presented by Andy Duckworth. Thanks for listening. They've probably got stuck in traffic or something. And, you know, the stairwells here get really busy. Oh, are you still there? Oh, don't worry about me. You go. You don't need to stick around. It's okay. I'll just give it a couple more minutes. I've got a bit of work to finish off in here. They won't be long.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
They might have sent me a text message. My phone's not in here. I'll go and check my phone. Hmm. Okay.